Are we set to go, Gavin? You brilliant person,
I'm here,
you.
Ready. Yeah. It's pouring with rain. It's pouring with rain, but I'm ready. I'm inside.
Well, as you well should be. I have admired your work for so long, but to really do a deep dive into watching Silo, wow. You really blew me away with what you designed and created here.
Well, it's very kind of you to say. It's obviously me and a lot of other people, but I had some control, I suppose, in those directions early on. And I suppose after doing this for quite a few years, you do understand how well and how quickly to use your experiences to make something work, hopefully. But, you know, it's always a bit of a guess. We're never quite sure how things are going to work out.
Well, your prior experiences definitely aided you with creating the production design of Silo, just because of the dystopian nature and a lot of the concrete edges, the circular tunnel. I see a lot of influence that came out of those Star Wars films.
Yeah, I think sometimes that information in your head is something that is always with you when you're looking at the blank piece of paper, so to speak. And you can't always quantify where it's come from, because you also have your own up-to-date research that you look for, you know, with your researchers and looking online. And obviously with AI, that's coming in now, getting us as much research as we can. But the amount you have stored in your head over 25, 30 years is obviously a huge amount of information that I'm probably naturally accessing without realizing it.
Well, I'm glad you have all that information to access it for this series, Gavin. I'm curious, where did you even start with Silo in designing this? I'm curious if you got any influences from the graphic novel, the 2014 graphic novel.
No, it's interesting that, I mean, obviously I started on the show by meeting Morton Tilden and Graham Yost, the showrunner. And having your normal interview, and, you know, they knew the work I'd done, and I hadn't read the novels, but I knew of them, so I sort of knew what the world probably needed to be in a very sort of loose term. And at that point, you just start to, you basically have a blank piece of paper, but there's a lot of discussions that go on, because you're led by Graham's great scripts and Morton, you're led initially by their ideas. When I've been involved in projects before with source material as such, I tend to avoid reading it or looking at it, because it sort of just clouds the mind a little bit. You know, the script is very different than Hugh Howey, the writer of the novels, would say. You know, it's a very different medium, the written novel, and he accepted very broadly what Morton and Graham and I were going to suggest. You know, he didn't mind where we went. You know, he had his own thoughts, but he thought everybody who read the books probably had different thoughts anyway. So I tend to avoid the source material looking back. And I say there's been two or three projects in the past that have had sort of novels previously, but and it's not through any negative thought. It's just, no, I'm working to the script. And if the script is quite defined, then that's where I need to be, you know, for right or wrong.
Obviously, the most defining element of this entire script is the silo itself and its construction. I am just enamored with your design of the silo proper, but then also the various component pieces, such as the mechanical level, the interior offices of judicial or the mayor. I see things coming in with like 1930s, 1950s, mid-century American design coming in. So talk to me about designing, starting with the silo proper as a whole, because I love the ovoid windows that you put in, all the portals.
Yeah, I think we referenced it right at the beginning. We knew our time period. You know, the silo had been built 50 years from now, and it was now about 250, 300 years old. So we knew we had an idea of how we might have to treat textures and finishes in that sort of bit, and make sure that you noticed that. But our initial thoughts were, through Graham and Morton, that, you know, we were going to be referencing sort of East European socialist architecture. That was our sort of very sort of austere, functional sort of look, trying to be a little bit nondescript. Mm-hmm. And some of the early designs that I sort of put together, very simply in model form, we introduced quite a lot of, say, metalwork work into the support structure of the silo. But we all agreed that pretty quickly it started to look a bit too sci-fi. You know, as soon as you started to introduce those sort of, not clean lines, but like structural lines, and we just felt if we stayed in that sort of concrete world of architecture with very low technology, we were going to give our world, A, its own personality, but B, a rather nondescript one. But within that, from what you said, the challenges, the advantages and challenges were that the advantages was that it was all one architecture. So whenever we were designing all the other sets and locations, the offices, the farmlands, the dark void, we knew we had a narrow design world to work in because it was all part of the same piece of architecture. But the negative side of that is that we also wanted to make these different areas quite distinct and quite noticeably different, you know, because you're always trying to help move the story along, tell the characters, you know, explain the characters a little more. And I think, as you say, with the offices, with Amanda Bernstein, the set, my set decorator, and Johnny Norman in props, they did a brilliant job of dressing these sets. We all worked together, but obviously their prime job is to work out how the dressing would work within these ever-changing environments. And it was quite interesting because functionally, Amanda and as an art department, we couldn't afford to hire all this furniture in from prop houses because the length of hire time was too long, literally, you know, 10 months and maybe into series two. And we couldn't afford to buy it all either. You know, that was sort of so what Amanda did and her team was they sort of scoured all the local antique markets and what you might call garage markets, and then also the eBay and the internet. So ironically or interestingly, she was then purchasing all of this sort of secondhand recycled world and using it to dress the silo. But interestingly, that's how the silo lived too. You know, they recycled all their furniture. You know, things from the upper level would end up in the mid level, and the mid level stuff would eventually end up in the bottom level, you know, as it got more repaired and more damaged. So there was a nice connection there. And I think what we tried to do was make very distinctive separation between the upper levels, which were the main offices and the municipal and the mayor's office and the judge's chambers. Then you went to the mid level, and obviously down in the down deep, as it were, that was a very grubby, damp, wet, destroyed area. So I'm glad that you could sort of pick that up in the episodes, because you know we're so close to it. Sometimes we never know how all those things are going to come together, and are we going to be able to? Is the audience going to understand the separation as you move down through the silo? But from what you say, it seems to work.
I just loved those touches within the interior design of some of these units and floors. And it also plays in well because they talk about before the rebellion, you know, everything was, they burned everything. They burned all the books. They burned all video. There was nothing. But this nobody talked about destroying the physical items such as furniture. So you know it came from somewhere originally.
I think our reference point exactly as you said earlier was anything from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s was going to be valid. And I think either by design or by default, I think Amanda ended up creating its own look within that without being too specific. You know, you could sort of tell maybe each individual piece may have been from a certain period. But as you put the whole collage together of, hey, the designs of the rooms, the colours, the textures and the furnishings, I think it did bring out its own sort of look for the silo, which I say, you know, we all try to do this as best we can, but you never know until the show comes out whether it works or not.
I think it works beautifully. Now, taking away from the silo as a whole, and we get into some very specific areas that obviously great attention was paid to because of the importance in the story, starting with mechanical. That and the generator, that whole thing is just phenomenal to watch.
Yeah, I think in the first three episodes, they were Morton's episodes to begin with. You know, he was in a sense the lead director, and he was very strong in pushing that whole sequence to be as big and as emotional, as exciting. exciting as it is. And as most productions, we didn't really have enough time, we didn't have enough money, and we didn't have enough stage space. So you're always working very closely with the logistics and the finances side, and with visual effects, understanding that the classic question of where do we build to and where do visual effects build. And as long as you've got a good team with you and you're discussing these things openly, you can come to a really good solution. The difficulty is that we, from an art department point of view, we can cost our sets quite easily because we're paint, we're nails, we're wood, we're metal. Whereas the visual effects side, their costs are based on shot counts, really. And they don't know what their shot count is almost until they see the final edit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't know how many. So there's always this sort of, can I say guesstimate is the right word, but it's experience, really, where we're talking to Daniel Rortberger in the visual effects and with the producers and with us and with the directors, and you're trying to make that best decision on how much you build. And I think in the generator room, we had many models that we built, digital models laid out on the stage. So the director, Morton, would have enough physical set to shoot against, but wherever possible, we would see the expanse of the whole generator room. And I think we ended up with about 120 degree, like cake slice, of the generator room leading out from the central area up to the control room.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, it looks, sometimes when you look at the finished article, it looks like we knew how that layout was going to be from day one. But it took an awful lot of ideas and designs and layouts and where's the control room and the steps up. And, you know, it takes a long time to get those things into place and decisions made. You know, it looks like it was all, okay, that's quite straightforward. There's the center, there's the steps, there's up to the control room. But there's a lot of, you know, interesting discussions goes on between everybody to get there. But I'm particularly pleased with that set because I think it really did, for the amount of money we had, and I know nobody cares about that in a sense, but for the amount of money we had, the value we got out of that room and how Morton shot it was really, really brilliant.
I think that room is just beautiful. And when we see it, especially when things are broken and the generator gets opened up so that she can try and fix it, you get this great sense of the magnitude of what this generator is to power this entire mile-high silo. And it's
I could probably show you, you're quite interesting thinking about that because it brings back memories for me. We probably showed Morton 20 or 30 different ideas for the inside of that turbine, what it should look like, but also practically what could we produce that would be practical to shoot and be sensible to the audience and also look realistic. You know, we're in a fantasy world, but it had to have some feeling that it was inside,
sure,
of a real turbine generator. So, you know, you always fudge your things and the reality and not reality, but I think it came across okay, didn't it?
So how much of that turbine did you actually build?
The actual bit that they climbed up to adjust.
Wow.
Yeah, we built on the ground level where you know where you first see her inside the door down below.
Right.
There's that, when she's doing the machinery in there. So we built that section up to about 15 feet, but then they get pulled up in the bosun's chairs up to the higher level. And that was a separate set. That was a separate set that was just one section of the of the inside of the silo. So that was, otherwise we were 200 feet up in the air, you know, we couldn't, mm-hmm, you know, so there was a lot of VFX enhancements when you're up on that upper level. But also Morton shot, you know, it's quite claustrophobic. You were quite inside the turbine, so you didn't always see out to the wider view. It was much more emotional when you were really close inside there with the trying to do what they had to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kept waiting for one of those rotor blades to like fall off and hit someone in the head.
Well, one did fall down.
But it didn't kill anybody, luckily. Now, we go from something like that to all the way up to the top of the silo with that surveillance room, which is so high-tech. It has a sci-fi kind of surrealness to it, especially with the grayish, the deep grayish blue-green palette that we have in there, the steely tones.
Yeah, the architecture is still the same. You're still in the bowels of the silo itself, but obviously the technology at that point was jumping a level. and there was quite a lot of chat about how far that goes, because I think as you, and I haven't read the novels, and I'm not sure where it'll go in two and three necessarily, but I know there's then another level above that, you know, where the founders are. This is the next level of technology, but there is even another level of technology past that, which I think you get a hint of at the end of the first series, where the Tim Robbins character sort of enters into another room.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know where that is at that point. But I think it was quite important for us to get our low-tech technology, like the screens and the graphics on the screens, was very much a sort of an 80s look, like in the early days of desktop computers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very hard in those early days making that first desktop computer not to make it look like something that Apple had produced in their early days. Going back to those first days, you had to be very careful. Oh, well, that looks a bit too much like that. You know, that's how they started, you know, gray boxes, really.
I love the contrast, and as we go higher in the silo, we see the different technology. We see things are a bit more polished, a bit more advanced. So we really get a sense of the class system. You really help fuel that for us.
Yeah, no, that's good. And, sometimes you don't, you can't explain that too much in the dialogue.
No.
I'm going down to this level, it's dirty. You have to rely sometimes, obviously, on how it's looking and how the actors are working in there. And I say, it's hard for us sometimes, we're too close to it, but I think the audience generally got a pretty good idea of what levels they were in at certain points and how people were living in the area. We had lots of other ideas that often don't make it into the show. We had a nice idea that as they were always going to be washing the floors of the upper levels because, hey, there's a lot of dirt and grime. And the cleaners, and a nice reflection with the water on the floor is always good. And we felt that they would be washing, they would be sweeping that water over the balcony edges through gullies just to go down to the lower levels. So if this was happening through the 140 levels, by the time you got to level 144, they would be continually under this waterfall of water that would had been swept off the upper balconies down below. But it just proved a little too difficult to make happen. But it would have been a nice idea that, you know, the ones downstairs are so fed up because they've just got this continual barrage of water being swept down from the upper levels. But, you know, you go through many conversations like that on a show like this where you're at world building, just trying to understand and make things obvious to the audience. But sometimes they don't work for the script or financially or for the storytelling. So, but we had, you could imagine we had quite a lot of good fun exploring various ideas.
As I'm watching it in the railings and the spiral staircase, which is spectacular, there are so many things that my mind was reeling with what might be coming, what might be happening, you know, how it could be utilized. And
yeah, I think I've been putting a few things on Instagram, like behind the scenes of Silo, just in this, because, you know, we're all quiet at the moment because of the strikes, basically. And there's some nice things in there about the test rigs we did for the staircase, you know, just trying to get the staircase the right width, the right size,
mm-hmm.
and full-size pieces, just to understand how people could walk up or walk down, and do they walk on the right or do they walk on the left, or do we have... We did think about having two intertwined staircases at one point, which we could have done like a DNA profile. There were two spiral staircases within the same space, and one was for going up and one was for coming down, which is quite a nice conceptual solution, but obviously didn't really work for storytelling because you wanted people to be passing on the stairs, not on a separate staircase. But, you know, fun things to explore in this mad world.
You know, how large was the spiral staircase that you built?
Well, I haven't got the exact dimensions, but the central shaft that was about 6 or 8 feet across, the main column that went right up through the middle, and then the stairs were about 10 feet wide as they came down with a 6-inch drop on each step. And the balconies were approximately 30 feet apart. So, and within that 30 feet, each level have about 3 floors within it, 2 or 3 floors. So, and you could only exit at a level. You couldn't, every 30 feet, you could tell there was only a walkway from the stairs every 30 feet to each level. And we built two, they were very keen to have 2 balcony levels constructed. So you could take an actor from one level down the stairs determine the height of the stage we needed. And we were shooting in not a real studio. It was in an empty industrial building. And we had about a 45-foot ceiling height, which wasn't really quite enough because it didn't have a grid. It wasn't a film stage. But the visual effects and Mark Patton, the DP, were very flexible and said, look, we know how important it is for the director to have these two balcony levels that you could shoot together. And they sort of compromised on what they needed to do at the top of the stage with blue screens and grids. So there are always challenges. And we built 270 degrees of the circle of the silo. The other 90 degrees were blue screen, which was an advantage because sometimes you needed to create a completely different background of different buildings or a farmland or something. And obviously we couldn't keep doing that every time we came back to the stage. The word jigsaw puzzle tends to really suggest how it was.
Well, and looking at the way it is constructed with corridors and walkways and all, it is like a jigsaw puzzle, Gavin. It really is.
And it's a jigsaw puzzle of everything in terms of the logistics, the shooting, the finance, and the actual architecture itself. But we did go through many iterations of the design of the silo itself based on the same principle, a mile deep shaft with a central staircase. But you could imagine there were 20 or 30 options you could put in that brief that would be quite different. But it's funny, sometimes I think if I look back at that work now, the ideas we came up with probably in the first 3 or 4 weeks were what we ended up doing, using or deciding on 10 weeks later. It's often your instinctive first passes can be where you end up. Sometimes you can have too much time to think about things. And, I think that's quite nice that your gut feeling, your instinct ends up being, that first instinct was actually quite a good idea.
The last big piece of this puzzle that you have created is that exterior. What in the world? I mean, I'm guessing that the greenery portion, the beautiful portion of outside, that may have been visual effects, but the structural aspect.
We built a tiny piece of it, 12 feet square, for when I think one of the act characters puts their hand down into the grass, but it becomes digital. It becomes like strange, but they wanted a real bit to start with. But basically Daniel in the visual effects department and Morton, we did some illustrations, some concepts, and got lots of reference as well for green, beautifully green landscapes. But they also had to make it look, because when you look at it, it sort of looks real in their headset. But they're looking at it through a headset. So any screen could be slightly pixelated. Sure. So it wasn't picture perfect, if you know what I mean. So you were never quite sure if that's how they were interpreting on the monitor in their helmets. Or was it real? And I think obviously that's quite a big exposition at the end where you pull back and you see Juliet in this vast sort of moonland landscape.
Yeah, it very much gives the impression of, filled with craters like on the moon. And I was very curious whether you actually built a portion of that, especially with the dead tree there and the little rocks to, the rock steps to walk up to the top of the hill.
The first thing you often do on a show is see what locations you can use for the story. What works. If you can find a great location and it fits financially and everything. We did do a little bit of location scouting, but we all knew pretty quickly that because of the specific look of the architecture of the silo, that nothing we found on location architecturally was going to fit into that world. So there was a big decision made, after a few weeks with production. Look, we have to try and build all of this, all with visual effects. We have to produce it. But the one location we did have was when they came out onto the exterior silo. So we were simply about 10 minutes away from the studio in an open field in a cucumber farm. That was our location. It was just an open field. So we built the exterior of the ramp where they walk up out of the ramp. And then we built 30 foot wide section of the landscape up and over the crater. So that was about 150 feet away. So we built this sort of narrow, 30 feet wide. a narrow strip that, that meant the actors could physically be walking on physical set. But we didn't put the, we did talk about putting the tree in or not, but then Daniel in visual effects said it's probably easier for them to add it because they need to have it both in the green version and the dead version as well. But yes, that was the only location we did. It wasn't a location we sort of shot. We shot as the location. We built it on location. And it was basically from the pillbox where the camera is, where she walks around to clean the script. The doors, with the doors, we didn't do the doors opening in the exit. That was a visual effect from inside. And then enough of the landscape for her to walk up, feel the bodies on the floor, and then finally disappear over the top edge. So, yeah, we built enough facet, you know, how much do we build and how much do visual effects do, and that seemed the sensible answer in that case.
Well, one last question for you, Gavin. I mean, I'm fascinated with all the work that you put into Silo because I see it all on the screen, and it's just incredible. What would be what you found to be the most gratifying aspect of what you designed for this series?
I'll split it into two. I think because I have to say, you know, we're always tight with money and spaces, stage space. You know, that's always whatever size project you do. There's never enough. You always want it, the producers, the studio want it to look more than the money you have, which is fine. That's what it should be. So what we managed to do in the Silo shaft set on a reasonable budget with a brilliant construction manager, Steve Byrne, who we've worked with before, in a stage that wasn't really quite big enough. And I spent, you know, weeks like analyzing my little 3D model in the stage base to use every inch, every section of that as much as we could, but still allowing, you know, health and safety and practicalities to work. So to get that set working on the level it was probably the biggest. That was like, wow, that's, we did well here, I think, on that basis, because the whole of the story in a funny sort of way revolves around that staircase, doesn't it? I mean,
yes.
you can't actually get away with it. But I think the other side is something that you mentioned earlier on, where you do get a really good idea of the different levels of the silo, in, of the interiors, and the more destroyed, cracked areas down below, the better dressing, decorating upstairs. I think the fact that, as you said at the beginning, that works very well, that's the most satisfying, that the fact that we managed to create this world, which had its different areas, and yet was all one architecture, which I say right at the beginning, I said that was the hardest bit in one sense, because it was just one architecture, but then on the other side, it gave us a few advantages that we knew we could repeat certain bits of architecture in certain places, but we still had to make them look different.
Well, you definitely succeeded on every level, Gavin. I am enamored with your work and this series. I hope I'm getting a season two.
Well, we're not doing it, though. They're doing that now. We were already on another show when they went ahead with it. So, hey, that's life. But from my point, to be honest, you know, I've been doing this quite a while, and it's much more exciting to just do a new project. I don't, you know what I mean? 90% of the sets that we produce for season one will be seen in season two. You know, there's, you know, that's how it is. And, you know, there comes a point where you just want to, well, I think I'd like to do a slightly different project. So we were doing a project based on Wind in the Willows with Toad of Toad Hall.
Okay, well, I'm once everybody's up shooting again, I will look for that. But I'm glad your work will live on in season two of Silo.
Yeah, no, I think, and I'm just as happy to see season two as everybody else. But I didn't read the novel, so I don't know where the story goes. So you can be excited. I can be excited as an audience member as well. But it's very kind of what you said, and it makes us even, you know, doubly more proud of what we all managed, because it was quite tough over 18 months. You know, it's never easy and lots of challenges along the way, not complaining, but, you know, coming out of COVID and working through COVID and all of those things, not just us, everybody in the whole production. You know, it's good that people appreciate it, because, you know, we all work on things that don't work sometimes.
Amazing job, Gavin. That's all I can say. I love it. I can't wait to see your next work, and I hope we get to chat again.
No, I'm always here if you want to get my number. number or something, I'm always here on email, so I'm always happy to. I mean, what I've been doing these things on Instagram, it's interesting because you never get a chance sometimes to look back or really explain how things were put together. And just for people coming up in the art department looking at not the glamour side of the film business of what we do in the art department, but actually the interesting challenges we have trying to make all these things come together. And it's good to look back and have a bit of reflective time sometimes. So I'm trying to appreciate the quiet times at the moment and go back. And I've even been going back as I've been putting some images from young Indiana Jones on there, for one of the first things I ever did. And, you know, there's some very interesting photographs back from that time, as you could imagine.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, Gavin, thank you so much. And hopefully we will do this again.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, it's very kind of what you said. So, yeah, and really nice to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Gavin. You have a great week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.